Well, it was about a month ago that on one of our days off, Jane and I were going round the British Museum. And we were specifically looking out for things in the British Museum that related into the scriptures, and we then happened upon this plate. It's a 6th century BC Persian drinking cup, and it has this inscription around the rim of it. The inscription was in cuneiform, which I don't read, so we have a translation of it. And it says, Artaxerxes, the great king, king of kings, king of lands, son of Xerxes the king, the Achaemenid, in whose house this silver drinking cup was made. So we know that this is a Persian 6th century BC Persian drinking cup belonging to Artaxerxes I, who reigned from 465 to 424 BC. And what is interesting about this is this Artaxerxes was the king that Nehemiah served. And we read in Nehemiah 1, which we'll have read to us in a moment, that Nehemiah was cupbearer to the king. So we stood in front of this silver cup in room 52 of the British Museum, and we were in touching distance of Nehemiah. It was quite an amazing moment, actually, because there was a strong chance that Nehemiah handled this very thing in the British Museum. You must go and see it. It sends shivers down my spine. Well, let's find out a little bit more about Nehemiah, and I'm going to ask Jane to come and read.
Nehemiah 1, beginning at verse 1. Nehemiah's prayer. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Kislev, in the 20th year, while I was in the citadel of Susa, Hanani, one of my brothers, came from Judah with some other men, and I questioned them about the Jewish remnant that had survived the exile, and also about Jerusalem. They said to me, "Those who survived the exile are back in the province and are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire." When I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. Then I said, "Lord, the God of heaven, the great and awesome God, who keeps his covenant of love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my ancestral family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly towards you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses. Remember the instruction you gave your servant Moses, saying, 'If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands, then even if your exiled people are at the farthest horizon, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. I was cupbearer to the king. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, "May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" The king said to me, "What is it you want?" Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king, "If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried, so that I can rebuild it." Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked me, "How long will your journey take, and when will you get back?" It pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. I also said to him, "If it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates, so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah? And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple, and for the city wall, and for the residence I will occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was on me, the king granted my requests." So I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. The king had also sent army officers and cavalry with me.
Thanks, Jane. Well, it's an amazing story, and it would be fun, actually, to read right the way through Nehemiah, wouldn't it, today? But we just got chapters 1 and the first half of chapter 2. When Nehemiah got the news of the state of Jerusalem, it says he sat down and wept. Many years later, when Jesus came to Jerusalem, he had the same response. It says in Luke 19, as Jesus approached Jerusalem and saw the city, he wept. Because Nehemiah's Jerusalem had rebelled against God and lay in ruins. It was a heap of rubble. Jesus' Jerusalem had rebelled against God and was devoid of faith. Today, the story is not that different, actually. I've been in Jerusalem in the last few weeks. And I think God still weeps over Jerusalem. Nehemiah sat down and wept. But he didn't stop there. Like Jesus after him, he wasn't a man of mere platitudes. He was a man of action. So he went to God. That was his starting point. He started with God. Now, I think so often, we start in the wrong place, don't we? I know for myself, there are too many occasions in my life when I go off and make my own plans and then I ask God to bless them. Do you ever do that? You know, you've got your own plans in your mind. You head off, you start sorting it all out, and then you think, oh, I should pray about this. And it's actually the wrong way round. Nehemiah starts with God. In recent times, the last few weeks, I have become all too aware of my own shortcomings when it comes to planning the future. This is what James said about planning the future in James 4. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, make money. Why? You do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. We don't know what will happen tomorrow. We don't know even what the weather it will be. We haven't got a clue what might hit us tomorrow. The truth of this scripture has become incredibly evident to me when it comes to the Go and Grow project. Because we are not the masters of our own destiny. We are not in control of the circumstances that we find ourselves in. Last week on the Go and Grow project, we were scheduled to exchange contracts on last Wednesday. And we had a project board meeting on Tuesday, and we just had a couple of items that needed to line up before we could finally say, yes, we are ready, and it is appropriate now that we exchange contracts on this massive project. But when we met as a project board, the news had just come in half an hour before that the figures just didn't look quite right. And we went through them and we realized that there were still two items that were not, they were not sufficiently lined up for us to, with confidence, say that we could proceed. And so we decided that we couldn't exchange contracts on Wednesday. Instead, on Wednesday, we went to the vendors and we said, we need a little bit more time. We're ever so nearly there, but we just need a little bit more time to sort out these couple of outstanding issues, and then we can proceed. Well, the vendors declined that proposition, and instead they said, you know, we've waited long enough, we are now withdrawing the papers and we're putting the property back on the market. So as I stand before you today, we do not have a purchase agreed on Solar House. Now we're trying to resolve this. Interestingly, since Tuesday, the two major items that hadn't quite lined up have, to a large extent, done so. And so we feel much more confident now than we did on Tuesday. But the vendors are not so happy with us. So we don't know where that's going to end up. You see, we are not the masters of our own destiny. We don't control the circumstances around us. And as that is true of the Go and Grow project, it was true of Nehemiah, and no doubt it is true of your lives in all sorts of arenas, that we're not in control. We sometimes like to feel as if we're in control, but it's an illusion. We're not really in control. But we know a God who is. So Nehemiah got the bad news from Jerusalem, and he was incredibly disturbed by it. It was the month of Kislev. That is, in our language, November, December. We're coming into it in the next week or two. The month of Kislev. It was the year 446 BC. The next thing we read it is the month of Nisan, and that is April, May, year 445 BC. In other words, 5 months later. The Bible says, for some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. For some days, those some days, it turns out, were 5 months. Little bit of a kind of underestimate there by Nehemiah. 5 months. What was he doing for 5 months? The process of sitting down and weeping and then taking this problem to God took Nehemiah 5 months. Now, Nehemiah had never been to Jerusalem. He had grown up in exile. But no doubt he'd heard all the stories of the beauty of Jerusalem, all the stories of its illustrious history. And he was devastated when those stories came crumbling down in his imagination, and he realized that it really didn't exist anymore. Some of those 5 months must have been just taking in that bad news. But then there was the praying as well. This wasn't just a snap, one-off, rattled-off quick prayer. This was persevering prayer. This was weeping prayer. Pouring out his soul before the Lord, fasting before God. And at the end of those 5 months, he was ready. Now, the prayer in chapter 1 that Jane read to us, of course, is a digest of that 5 months of intensive prayer that Nehemiah went through. And somewhere along the line in those 5 months, Nehemiah sensed God telling him what to do. And the final line in the prayer was, "Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man." The man in question was no mere man. He was the king. Nehemiah is resolved. He is setting out on the most dangerous undertaking of his life. There will be no going back. What he's about to do is to risk everything. So Nehemiah, he'd been praying for 5 months, and then he went to the king. Now, in this case, the king is King Artaxerxes I. He is the emperor of the Achaemenid Empire. To us, that is the Persian Empire. According to the Guinness Book of Records, this empire, when it was at its peak, and in truth, it was probably at its peak under Artaxerxes' father, Xerxes, but it was almost at its peak under Artaxerxes. When it was at its peak, it ruled over 44% of the world's population, and that is the highest figure for any empire in history. Remember that inscription on the silver plate? Artaxerxes, the great king, king of kings, king of lands, son of Xerxes the king. Well, it's hard to disagree with the inscription. This Artaxerxes was a great king. He was king of kings. He was king of lands. He was far and away the most powerful man on the planet. And he was arguably one of the most powerful men who has ever lived. Well, was Artaxerxes the first? Was he a good king? Well, I think good and king, when it applies to the ancients, probably doesn't really go together. But he was certainly an effective king. Centuries later, the Roman emperors had this maxim,
parcare subjectis et debilere superbus. Anyone speak Latin? Did I get that right? To spare or to subdue. To spare and to subdue. In other words, to show mercy to those who submit to our rule and to make total war on those who challenge it. Now, that maxim was taken by the Roman emperors, but it could have been applied to Artaxerxes. He was incredibly ruthless on those who rebelled against him. And yet he could be surprisingly gentle with those who were prepared to submit to his rule. Now, the thought of going to such a man with anything but an attitude of total submission was at best terrifying and more probably complete lunacy. And yet that is what Nehemiah had resolved to do. Now, the Bible has quite a lot to say about submitting to those in authority over us, and most notably in Romans 13, verse 1, where it says, "Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established." The amazing thing about that verse is that Paul wrote it during the reign of the Emperor Nero. Now, Nero is one of the worst despots of all time. He murdered two of his wives, and he murdered his mother. He killed most of the Roman ruling elite. He virtually bankrupted the empire. He murdered Christians by clothing them in animal skins and allowing wild beasts to tear them apart in the arena. And then another way of killing Christians was he would daub them with tar, tie them on posts, and set them alight for illuminations in his garden parties. That was Nero. And Paul says, submit to those in authority over you. This is an extraordinary thing. The need to submit to the person in authority over you, however brutal and ruthless they were, was not lost on Nehemiah. He knew the need for this well. He was cupbearer to the king. He wouldn't have got to such an elevated position without submitting to Artaxerxes' every whim and wish. To show sadness in front of the king was potentially grave offense. You just don't do that. You certainly just don't do that because you got out of bed the wrong side. He wouldn't have got to such an elevated position if he went round doing that. Because Artaxerxes could just say, "I'm irritated by this cupbearer," and that would be the end of him. So you wouldn't show sadness in front of the king unless you wanted to raise an agenda with him. And that was a very dangerous thing to do. So Nehemiah went into the king, and it says, "I had not been sad in his presence before." Too right he hadn't. This was an intentional and dangerous strategy. Artaxerxes immediately rumbled what was happening. And he says, "Why does your face look sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." And then Nehemiah records, "I was very much afraid." His life was on a knife edge. It could go either way. No wonder Nehemiah prayed. It says, "Then I prayed to the God of heaven and answered the king." This wasn't a 5-month prayer. This was a quick arrow prayer to God saying, I'm in trouble here. Now, I think one of the most impressive things about this action by Nehemiah is he really didn't need to do it. This man was comfortable. He was cupbearer to the king. He was someone who was trusted not to poison the king. Lots of ancient kings were poisoned. In fact, I think Nero was probably behind the poisoning of Claudius. So this was one of the most trusted people in the royal court. He therefore had very high status in the corridors of power. It could be that such a person would even have the ear of the king. And with this very responsible position came all the trappings of privilege. He would have lived in extreme comfort, his every need attended to. Why risk that? Why give it all up? Nehemiah, no doubt, could have lived in utter luxury for the rest of his life. All he had to do was keep his mouth shut, and he could live out his life in great comfort. And when I was reading about this, I was pondering whether, in fact, there were other cupbearers who were also Jews, who also heard the report of Jerusalem, but decided to do just that, to keep their mouths shut. And they probably did live very nice lives. But of course, we have no record of them. Their names are lost in the annals of time. Whereas Nehemiah, on the other hand, made it into the pages of the Bible. Because he chose to go out on a limb. He chose to risk everything for the purposes of God. Many of people who have chatted to me about the Go and Grow project, and the most common response when people hear about it is they say to me, "Well, it's very exciting, isn't it? Very exciting." And it is. It is exciting in the manner of an action movie where the eponymous hero is facing constant, impossible odds. He's put in situations where his life is on the line, and the movies leave the viewer breathless and wondering, how on earth is he going to get out of this scrape? He faces extreme danger. It is utterly terrifying and exhausting, and that's just for the cinema goer sitting in the comfy seat. Being involved in the Go and Grow project feels a little bit like living through an action thriller movie without so much the action. Comparing himself to his detractors, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 11, "I have worked much harder, been in prison more frequently, been flogged more severely, been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I've received from the Jews 40 lashes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 time I was pelted with stones. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I have been in danger from rivers, in danger from bandits, in danger from my fellow Jews, in danger from Gentiles, in danger in the city, in danger in the country, in danger at sea, and in danger from false believers. I have known hunger and thirst. I've often gone without sleep." I have been cold and naked, and beside everything else, I face daily the pressure of my concern for the churches. Who is weak, and I am not, I do not feel weak? Who is led into sin, and I do not inwardly burn? What Paul went through actually and physically, to some tiny little extent, we have been through metaphorically with the Go and Grow project. It is exciting. But exciting is not always enjoyable. Paul concludes, who is weak? And I do not feel weak. And I strongly identify with that verse. A feeling of extreme weakness has really been my story over the last few months. We are not masters of our own destiny. We do not control our circumstances. And we feel incredibly powerless. But then when I step back from the situation, I say to myself, when I became a Christian, I didn't sign up for a boring, pedestrian, mediocre life. I signed up to follow Jesus wherever he led, wherever he went, no matter what the cost, to risk everything. Jesus says in Luke 9, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will save it. Think about your life. What is it principally about? What do you spend most of your time investing your energy and talent and money and effort in? Do you spend most of your time investing and in your own comfort? Or are you one of those ones who's going to risk everything to do something for God? In other words, are you one of those other cupbearers whose names are lost now? We don't know who they are. Or are you going to follow Nehemiah's example? Well, Nehemiah, he went to God, he went to the king, he went on the mission. Nehemiah's problems didn't stop when he went on the mission, having got the king's support. In fact, in some respects, that's where the trouble began. They had an incredible difficult time rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. They were regarded as threats by those around them. Their detractors came offering support and even partnership while all the time planning to sabotage their efforts. And in the later stages, the opposition turned to violent assault with sporadic raiding parties. And it says in Nehemiah chapter 4, when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Amorites and the people of Ashdod heard that the repairs to the Jerusalem walls had gone ahead and that the gaps were being closed, they were very angry and they plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and stir up trouble against it. And we prayed to our God and posted a guard. Posted a guard day and night to meet this threat. Then verse 16, half of my men did the work, while the other half equipped with spears, shields, bows, and armor. The officers posted themselves behind the people of Judah who were building the walls. Those who carried materials did their work with one hand and held a weapon in the other. Each of the builders wore his sword at his side as his work. There was building and there was battle, and the battle and the building go together. The great Victorian preacher, Charles Spurgeon, was so struck by this concept of battle and building belonging together, he called his journal The Sword and the Trowel, after Nehemiah's attempts at rebuilding the walls. The sword and the trowel. Perhaps that is what should describe our lives. The sword and the trowel. How are we going to go about serving God? Sword in hand, trowel in hand. Right now, when I look at the situation that we find ourselves in, the Go and Go project, it is quite difficult to be positive. But there is, of course, a difference between positive thinking and faith. You can buy all sorts of self-help books on positive thinking, and they'll only get you so far. Faith goes further. Faith goes beyond circumstances. Faith perseveres when positive thinking runs out. I was speaking to a man the other day. He was telling me something of his life story and telling me about a time when he went through incredible difficulties, a really hard time in his life. His wife had died, and his employers were being very unpleasant to him, and he was desperate, crying out to God. And from that dark place, God spoke to him and said, every adversity and every adversary I will use for your benefit. And of course, that concords with the scriptures, doesn't it? Because we read in Romans 8:28, and we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And we know, do we know? Do you know that? That God works all things for the good of those who love him and called according to his purposes. Do you know that? Paul assumes that you do. Every adversity and every adversary God will use for your benefit. When you're really in the pit, it's very hard to see that, isn't it? It's very hard. But in retrospect, in years to come, if you keep your faith in God, you will be able to look back and say, yes, in all things, God works for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purposes. Are we going to go with God? Are we going to risk everything? Are we going to park the mediocre pedestrian life on the side and really go full out for God?